You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. And welcome to episode 355. And in this one, I got on psychotherapist Josh Fletcher. You may also know him by Anxiety Josh on Instagram. It was great to finally meet him in person a few weeks ago and get him on the show and share his kind of knowledge and wisdom with you guys. So in particular, we discuss his therapy story and his mental health journey, including OCD. We talk about what is anxiety, adrenaline and cortisol, panic attacks, having willful tolerance, meerkat mode, OCD, taboo, intrusive thoughts, and so much more. Josh does a really good job of going into the science of it all and the evolutionary view of anxiety and breaking that down. So I think you'll find it interesting. And thank you to NoCD for supporting the podcast. NoCD offers effective and convenient therapy available in the US and outside the US. To find out more about NoCD, their therapy plans, if they currently take your insurance, or to download their free app, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories, or the link will be in the episode description. So thank you as always to you guys for listening. It means a lot. And thank you to Josh for his time. I appreciate it. Without further ado, here he is. Welcome to the show, Josh.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on, Stu. I've been looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's been good to have you here. Obviously, I met you at the OCD Game Changers event in London, and we got to catch up, and hence you're here now. So I guess initially it'd be good to hear your therapy story. So what got you into being a therapist?
Good question. I got into being a therapist because for many years of my life growing up, I felt I didn't get the right help for my anxiety disorders, including OCD. Some therapy was helpful, some wasn't. And I developed a passion for psychoeducation, because what helped me in my kind of recovery from anxiety disorders was just kind of knowing what was happening in my mind, my body, knowing I wasn't going bananas, which often, you know, anxiety, OCD can help you make you feel. Yeah. And I just thought, you know, how can I combine my passion for teaching, because I was a teacher at the time, but with something else that I'm really passionate about. And that's when I thought, oh, yeah, I'd love to do that. I'd love to help people like I kind of help myself, really. I know that sounds really kind of self-important, but like the person that kind of got me out of it was me. Because at the time I felt I was being let down by my doctor and my modality inappropriate therapist. And so I started, I wrote a little self-help book for panic attacks when I was like 23, 24. And people really liked it. They were like, oh, wow. And like, you really get it. I was like, yeah. I know what panic disorder feels like. And then I started to be a therapist, a psychotherapist at master's level. And I started to learn about different modalities. I just became embroiled in it all. I love the psychology of it and the psychoeducation, and I love teaching and empowering people to help themselves.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing. I want to jump straight into it. Obviously, you know, a lot of people would know you that listen to my show through your Instagram account, Anxiety Josh.
I was born with that name. My mum named me Anxiety first, a foreboding sense of doom already. Such a fatalistic name.
So I call you Anxiety from here on out. So I guess I wanted to start at the basics. You know, what is anxiety? How would you describe that?
Oh, I love it. Let's bring it back to basics. Anxiety is your body's threat response. It's your threat response. It's when the body senses threat. And anyone with anxiety and OCD will know this phrase, just in case. If the body, the mind thinks that there's a threat, then it will engage just in case. Just in case. So it's not just a threat, but a potential threat. Mm. What it will do is that the, you know, forgive me if I'm going over old things or teaching grammar to suck eggs, but like, you know, in your brain, there's the part, the threat response part called the amygdala, which is the master composer. It's in charge, really paranoid part of your brain, really thinks everything's out to get you. And what it'll do is that if it senses any semblance of threat, then it will release adrenaline, cortisol, either open or shut your peripheral vision, depending on your sex, make you feel, it'll make you hyper-focus on things either in front of you or, as people with OCD will know, hyper-focus on things in your imagination or images in your brain. And it will do everything in its power to keep your attention on it because it's potential threat. That's anxiety. To our ancestors, it was wonderful. You know, if they're walking across the Serengeti, there's a mechanism in their brain that makes us the most powerful predator in the world, top of the food chain. It's not their strength. It's not their intelligence. Well, it is partly their intelligence, but it's that idea that we have a threat response, doubt, anxiety, the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's doubt. So if they're walking across the Serengeti and suddenly they're filled with doubt, they're going to look up and scan for dangers. And lo and behold, there you go. There's your pride of lions. You know, you can hide from them or walk around them or, you know, butcher them later on if you want and have a Lion King themed barbecue. Mm. It's up to you. It wasn't the fact that we were stronger than a lion. It's not necessarily kind of smarter than a lion, but is the fact that, yeah, we can use anxiety as part of our intelligence to plan ahead, you know, to analyze that. So, yeah, that's anxiety. Now, you know, that's the threat to our ancestors were that, quite blatant threats. If the threat was not a lion, it was a bear, it was hyenas. Then you had kind of other threats like banishment, rejection. You know, if I'm banished from the tribe or rejected, my threat response isn't going to like that either because I'm not going to survive on my own. Mm. And that's another reason why, you know, anxiety threat would happen. Mm. Obviously, in the modern day, you know, we have lots of modern jobs. We live in a relatively safe society. The threats have changed. The mechanism is exactly the same as it was thousands of years ago, but the threats are subjective. They've modernized. Mm. So threats could be threats to our self-esteem, threats to our job, threats to who we are, threats to our morality, which again, which is what, you know, kind of why it gets intertwined with OCD. The threat is no longer, mostly isn't, you know, blatant threats of snakes coming attacking us out in the trees. Mm. It's the threat is, oh, I've got to apprehend these modern threats. Yeah. When I teach my clients about, you know, anxiety, it's like that. Anxiety is a great thing. It makes us really powerful. You just don't feel very powerful when you're sat ruminating in, you know, in a dark room and you want it to stop, you know. But yeah, that's what it's there. It's there to fill you with doubt because doubt makes us the most powerful predator in the world. When that doubt becomes disordered, well, I needn't tell you, Stuart, or anyone listening.
Yeah, really good breakdown. Thank you for that. And what it made me think of as you were describing that, I know you studied humanistic psychology, but like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, like anxiety for us, at least in the Western world, is not so much on those core things anymore, like shelter and food. And now it's more on like the actualization and the love and belonging. That's where anxiety really latches onto.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Rejection, being pushed away. A lot of, I mean, they call it the fight, flight, freeze and fawn response, don't they? Because, which is more people can relate to, you know, when I work with panic attacks as such, you know, OCD and panic attacks go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, most people who panic actually freeze. Yeah. You know, it's not like on Netflix where they're running around, rolling around on the floor, gasping for air.
Yeah.
You know, that's not really what a panic attack is. They're mostly freeze responses, but also fawn, which again, when you know, if I placate and please this person, then there's less chance of me being rejected, pushed away, and in extreme cases, kind of abused, you know, that's the same threat response. It's the same thing. It's just how it presents. So yeah, it molds to modern threats. Yeah. About actualizing esteem. Who am I? Identity. Which is quite annoying, considering it almost feels like a redundant threat response. Like, why are you getting involved, old timer? You don't understand this modern world. And or they'd be like, yeah, but I'm the fastest thing in your brain and I'll do what I want.
Yeah. And of course, ultimately it's trying to help, right? It just is in overdrive. So what I've liked about hearing some of your stuff is when you talk about adrenaline and cortisol. And I just thought if you could share a bit about that would be useful.
Yeah. So when I struggled, I'll just use my own story, hence where, you know, it's the nature of your podcast. And so I first struggled more with panic attacks before OCD. So I struggled with panic disorder first at a very stressful time of my life. I was working in a pupil referral unit, which, if anyone doesn't know what that is, it's for like a school for children who can't access mainstream education, either through their behavior issues or psychological issues or just mitigating circumstance. And that was a stressful job. I loved it. It was a brilliant job. You know, time never flew by slowly in a pru, but it was stressful. At the time, I was a carer for my younger brother, Harry, who was terminally ill with cancer. So I'd go to a crew and then come home and look after him. What I didn't realize all this time was that all the stress and burning out my nervous system was happening in the background. I didn't really know anything about that, didn't really believe in that stuff. I just thought I could just get on with things. Then at the time I was going through a breakup. I didn't necessarily have a lot of money. I was grieving as well for my brother, trying to get on my mom while we were trying to care for him, coming out of like drug abuse, you know, like cannabis and stuff like that. And I did abuse it. It was a lot. And I'm filling up my stress jug slowly. Well, I'm doing it a bit, but mostly, you know, life circumstances did it. So one day I was in the pru making a nice cup of tea and I dropped the spoon and the spoon startled me slightly. And suddenly I was overwhelmed with this sense of derealization, depersonalization. I just felt like I wasn't in the room. I was like, whoa, that feels weird. I looked at my hands and was like, these aren't my hands. They're little meat sausages on a meat plate and they're moving around. And why are they doing that? I could hear my voice, but it didn't feel like mine. I just felt this sense of doom and dread. And I thought I had gone crazy. People walked into the room. And bear in mind, I struggled a bit with existential OCD as well, so it didn't help when people walked into the room and, you know, their faces looked like clay. And I thought, oh my God, we're all like automatons. And I've lost my mind. This is it. This is where it begins. What I didn't realize is that was a panic attack. It was a massive panic attack. It was a freeze, you know, fight, flight, freeze form. So it was a freeze response. And I went pale and people said, "You're all right." I was like, "I don't think I am." And then my heart started racing and then, dizziness and everything comes with a panic attack. What if thoughts? Yeah. I didn't know that part of that was to do with, I didn't know that was an adrenal flood. You know, I didn't understand what was happening into me. I've heard of adrenaline before, but no one explained to me, and no one did explain to me what was happening during panic for a long time until I stumbled across the works of Claire Weeks and people like that. But adrenaline and cortisol will make you feel that fear that comes with any anxiety disorder. And that's what I was feeling in that moment. And if someone would have told me that within minutes, I'd have saved myself a lot of time. Although, admittedly, I probably wouldn't have become a therapist and become really involved in it. But you know, it's adrenaline because you feel like something awful is about to happen, and physical effects of it, like you're tense and the heart's racing and you feel derealized and dissociated. That's adrenaline. And you know, it's cortisol. I call it the meerkat chemical because you just feel on edge, nervousness.
Yeah.
I don't, something bad's going to happen. Anyone who struggles with morning anxiety, which I did for many a time, that's because, you know, cortisol wakes you up in the morning. But if you're nervous and you've got a sensitive nervous system, probably have a bit more cortisol to wake you up in the morning. So you feel a bit like, I feel this dread and doom as I start the day. It's chemicals. It's the chemical reaction. It's cortisol. And I say that to me and my clients, like, that's okay. It's just cortisol. What are you going to do? Engage with it, ruminate on it, body scan, or just get on with your day. And adrenaline's that acute fear response that, ooh, something really bad's going to happen. And cortisol's like, I'm on edge. I can't relax. I feel quite nervous. Mm. And I like to kind of simplify it like that for people who struggle with anxiety.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's important because, and like you said before, and I use this with my clients now, that it's panic doesn't attack. You know, nothing is attacking you. It's an adrenaline rush. And when I've experienced it myself, you know, I told you not too long ago, I started feeling panic, and which isn't something I've really experienced before. Well, once years ago, but not in the same way I had. Just telling myself this is what's happening is adrenaline rush, like taking it back to the science of it, as opposed to I'm having a panic attack, which is terrifying.
Yeah, and I don't know who named it panic attack. It's not very accurate, you know, adrenaline rush, adrenaline flood, adrenaline, where that, and that's why no one's ever died from a panic attack, because well, nothing's attacking you, so it's not the right word. And the connotations with the word attack with someone who is having an adrenaline rush, it's not going to help, is it? It's okay, you're having a panic attack. What? I'm being, you know, that's not what I want to hear. Whereas I say, it's okay, you're just having an adrenaline rush. You can't stop it. So don't Google 5 ways to stop my panic attack. It's not going to happen. But what? Imagine the adrenaline going to doing a lap around your body, through the veins, all that. It's going to hit all the organs, and then it's going to leave. And it's impossible for it to maintain itself. So you've got to just tolerate it. And let's get good at tolerating it. And that was fascinating because me learning to deal with panic disorder, and I mean, my panic attacks are so bad. I developed agoraphobia, or agoraphobia, if you're across the Atlantic. Yeah. And I wouldn't leave the house for about 6 months. I was too scared to go to the toilet because I was afraid to feel anxiety. Yeah. So actually dealing with panic disorder actually set me up quite well to deal with OCD. Because I was like, oh, it's the willful tolerance thing again. But it just in different, it's the threat response, but in different things. So with panic attacks and panic disorder, my threat response had learned that panic itself was dangerous. So I tried to do everything to avoid it. I would have cut out caffeine, wouldn't go to certain places, you know, wouldn't drink a beer on a Friday that I enjoyed. I wouldn't go into busy areas. And if I did, I'd have micro avoidances like finding the fire exit or having a safe person. No, instead, you know, to deal with panic, I had to like willfully tolerate the adrenaline and cortisol and the doubt that hits you when doing that exposure. So when my OCD reared its head, you know, a few years later, it was like, I can kind of understand the principles here because it's the same threat response, just the threat itself is different.
Yeah, really good point. And obviously, the more we avoid it or don't want to feel it, the more we're going to feel it. And you know, you talked about willful tolerance there. If you could just go in a bit more detail, because I think it's a useful term.
So it's not mine. It's something that Marty Seif and Sally Winston talk about in their work. And it's something that resonated with me a lot. You hear this word a lot, like the worst, this word acceptance a lot. And I don't really, it doesn't resonate with me. I find it doesn't really resonate with a lot of OCD sufferers either. You know, if I'm having thoughts about killing my nan or sleeping with things I shouldn't, then someone telling me to accept that is going to jar me. And I know we had that discussion at the OCD Game Changers, which was interesting, actually. You know, it's for some people, acceptance works. It's not a slight on acceptance and commitment therapy. I like that. Just the word acceptance, the semantics of it. So, I like the word willful tolerance. We already tolerate it. You struggle with panic and OCD. You're already tolerating it. You've already done half of willful tolerance. You're tolerating it. You don't like it, but you're tolerating it. You're getting through the day. You're waking up. You're enduring things. You're enduring this doubt, this just in case, this horribleness. Maybe you're enacting in compulsions, but you're tolerating it. What we're doing now, though, is that we want to willfully tolerate it. It's the attitude. It was summed up best by one of my clients many years ago, permission for them to share this anecdote. They were like, what's the difference between willful tolerance and distraction? And they said, I think I get it. So I was at home, and when I get an intrusive thought or I want to do a compulsion or whatever, I go and play my PlayStation, but I run. I'm like, oh no, the anxiety's coming. I'm going to turn my PlayStation on. I'm going to pick a game and I'm going to play it. And just, you know, I can't let that in.
Yeah.
You know, and that was a coping mechanism that wasn't necessarily great because they didn't want to tolerate it. There was no willfulness to it. The same client actually came in and said, I did exactly the same this week, but I get it. And I did it right. And I was like, what do you mean by that? He said, I had the intrusive thoughts and I played the PlayStation. I was like, okay, talk me through it. He said, yeah. I said, I don't like this, but what would non-anxious me be doing right now? Mm. Well, actually, you know, I just finished work. There's nothing much I had to do.
Yeah.
I probably would have just played the PlayStation anyway. So I casually walked over, turned it on, sat, thought, right, what shall I play, you know, and gave it thought. And it was just the attitude of, well, I can't turn this threat response off immediately, so I might as well let it keep shouting while I'm playing the PlayStation. Yeah. And that was the difference. It's the same behavior, but one was willful tolerance, you know. Willful tolerance can be, you know, when you set yourself exposure challenges, you know, like, this is going to make me feel like pants, but I'm going to do it anyway because I know that the end goal is worth it.
Mm.
You know, whereas tolerance is like, right, I will go to the wedding, but I'm just going to sit there and count down the moments till I leave. That's not willful. It's like, you know, I've got to go and feel like rubbish. The people who struggle with willful tolerance, people who struggle with self-esteem issues because they see anxiety triggers, content of nonsense thoughts as a threat to their self-esteem, their identity. And when I'm working with people like that, you've got to, you know, and I know we were talking about this before, Stu, it's like something, when you're working with OCD clients, it's not just all OCD. It's like, it's the ripple effects of that. Yeah. And, you know, we're looking at, well, let's look at your confidence issues and your esteem issues and let's build that. So then we can willfully tolerate stuff when we do it, when we're working with anxiety disorders. Yeah, it's the willful tolerance of uncertainty. It's the core recovery mantra for all anxiety disorders. Mm. Not conventional anxiety. We're all allowed to, you know, we're all allowed to have this outwards conventional anxiety that everyone can relate to. Mm. But it's the inwards nasty, repetitive stuff where reassurance has often become our main compulsion or whatever. And that willful tolerance of anxiety is a skill that we practice. Which is something I did, which led to, you know, my recovery in inverted commas. Right. Also, it rewires the brain. You know, this is really important. This is something I bang on about in my practice all the time. I always ask, who gets the credit? Who got the credit for that, for riding out that uncertainty? Mm. So if you're someone who has an intrusive thought, say, about contamination, you know, and, you know, by the time that threat response turns off, who got the credit for it? Well, actually, in that time, I kind of washed my hands or cleaned that surface several times. Well, the brain will give the credit to the compulsion, not you. You know, I struggle with agoraphobia and I managed to go to the shop, but my partner had to come with me. I was like, well, did you get the credit for that? Not really, my partner. Well, have some credit because you went to the shop, but you didn't get all the credit for it because the brain thinks you can only do it with your partner. You know, what were you doing at this time? Who gets the credit for you going on that long journey? You know, well, actually, I had to tap my door 5 times, otherwise someone would die. Well, the door then got the credit, or you tapping the door got the credit, not you willfully tolerating the uncertainty walking down there. Yeah. It's so important. And for people who struggle with panic attacks as well, they have micro avoidances, micro safety behaviors that get the credit. So I often talk about, you know, I went somewhere with my magic bottle of water just in case I panicked. Well, so now the water is going to get the credit. Or I have my magic sweets just in case I panicked and you know, my blood sugar dropped. It's like, unless you're diabetic, you don't need that. Your body will regulate itself. You know, I have my mobile phone just to ring my safe person just in case I panic. Well, now your mobile phone and your safe person is getting all the credit. The brain will never learn that it was you that could tolerate that anxiety, and that applies to anxiety and OCD. So I was banging on about that. I'll get off my soapbox.
Well, worth sharing. Absolutely. Yeah, I like that idea of where the brain's giving credit. Yeah, brilliant. So you mentioned it earlier about meerkat. You called it something else, but I've heard you call it meerkat mode. I guess I just want you to expand on that, please.
Yeah, meerkat mode. We, as humans, adopted the same mechanism as the meerkat, which is, you know, if you picture a meerkat on TV, what's it doing? It's outside its burrow. It's looking up. It's looking for predators. And that's key to their survival. And we do exactly the same, except, you know, our burrows, our homes, our work offices, our walking around our lives. And it keeps us in a mode of hypervigilance. I think, Sally Winston and Marty Seif's, there's a quote, it resonated with me. It's not even a profound quote. It was just a sentence. It was just, anxiety hates any threat to hypervigilance. And that is our meerkat mode. You know, you don't see meerkats really, you sometimes see them playing and chilling out, but there's always one looking out for danger. And that's what we have to, except we do have the metacognitive ability to turn that threat response off. Each person's different. Obviously, if you've been through profound trauma and things like that, your meerkat mode is going to be harder to switch off. And it's not your fault. But in general, it's about turning off meerkat mode and going into sloth mode. Sloth mode is when and everyone can relate to this. How many people have just forgotten about their anxiety and OCD for ages? And then, you know, you hit with a backdoor spike, bang. Well, I'm not anxious anymore. And actually, anxiety, then you're not used to it. You're not used to being in sloth mode. I've spent a whole day on holiday not thinking about my anxiety or how I feel or my thoughts. All my focus has been external, and I actually felt normal for a bit. Well, thanks to habit and your neuropathway, sometimes I'll be like, whoa, that feels a bit weird. That in itself is a threat. Mm-hmm. Oh, bang, I'm back into meerkat mode again. Bang. And there's the cortisol, you know, that puts us into meerkat mode. If that happens to you, that is a good thing. Do not be disheartened. That means you're doing really well. It means you're doing really well. You're having more and more windows of time where you're not inwards focused. And it will feel a bit like a pang. And I don't know if you've heard it, Stu, but I've had this plenty of time. You're like, oh, I've not been anxious. Now it's making me anxious. That's a good thing. Just keep going. You know, just rather than criticize yourself for being, for no longer being in sloth mode, you're like, okay, well, I'm back in meerkat mode again. But actually, that was 8 hours where I wasn't in meerkat mode. And that's, again, it's really important to work on our self-esteem and have some compassion for yourself, because the person that will recover quicker will be like, well, that was 8 hours. I wasn't in meerkat mode. Pretty happy with that. And the critic will be like, oh, God's sake, I'm never going to get better. Look what you've done. You've done it again. You know, and it's so important to distinguish. So, meerkat mode's great, and it's great for, it's normal for stuff as well. You know, like I say normal loosely, but, you know, conventional for interviews, dates, whatever. But anyone listening to this podcast will know what meerkat mode's like when there's unconventional threat.
Yeah, yeah. And I like that it's, you know, called meerkat mode, because you can just visualize yourself in that mode, and it's kind of comical, right? And that can also snap us out of it a bit, especially if we do the impression too. And I think you're right there. I think you really need to praise those windows of time where things are better, whatever better means to you, because otherwise the brain wants to keep focusing on the negative, but we really need to keep focusing on, well, what's working, you know, even if it's like 10 minutes where I've felt normal. If that's abnormal to you, then that's great. Celebrate that. And then you're more likely to get those windows of time, as you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a short game I used to play, only short term. I didn't want it to develop into a compulsion in itself, but like, short game I used to play, just to change perspectives. So it was like, when you catch yourself anxious or just even checking, self-scanning, it was for the self-scanners. If you're a self-scanner, you know, where you check your body or your thoughts, and you annoyed at yourself for doing that. I know I used to get really annoyed at myself, used to beat myself up a lot for doing it. Just a little game I do over a couple of days with people is like, each time you catch yourself self-scanning or checking your thoughts, give yourself a point for every minute or second that you did without doing that. Just so it gives a balanced perspective. I didn't do it as much as I thought I was doing. And it shows that I can go through things without having this kind of inwards ruminative mental compulsion. And yeah, I'd do that for a couple of days just to give an alternative perspective. Obviously, don't do it all the time, unless it just becomes a compulsion in itself. But in general, yeah, that just to give that alternative view. And I found that kind of works.
Yeah.
In here. Yeah.
That's great. That's great. So look, you've shared loads on terms of what we can do around our anxiety and OCD. Is there anything else you want to share that can be helpful for people?
Yeah, I mean, you can do it. You know, it's my mantra is, if you struggle with OCD, with particularly with taboo intrusive thoughts, but in general, it thrives because it's the opposite of who you are. That's always my motto. OCD thrives and intrusive thoughts thrive because they're the opposite of who you are. And if it's not intrusive thoughts, it will be a self-sabotage because it's the opposite of who you are. I struggled with my first trigger a few days ago, which was really annoying. Because I remember being at OCD Game Changers, standing there like, I've been a year without having an OCD trigger. You know, but, and I was still in the back of my head is like, I'm going to pay for saying that. It's about 4 or 5 days ago, I had a trigger, and it's almost passed because I'm good at willfully tolerating, but like, a skill of practice. But yeah, I remember it's tried to self-sabotage. You know, I'm trying to, you know, like, I'll be honest, like my doctor says I need to lose weight. I'm losing a bit of weight and doing really well with it, praising myself. And then one day just stood on the scales and OCD was like, you're losing weight because you've got cancer. And I was like, oh no. And it just went bypassed my rationalization process, straight onto the hamster wheel, revved up that hamster wheel, and around and around and around you go. I was like, oh, for God's sake. And I had 24 hours of intense compulsions to the point where my partner came in and I'm in the bathroom at 3 a.m. just weighing myself 30, 40 times. I don't know why. It's compulsion, isn't it? Who knows? And yeah, I started to get really annoyed myself. And I thought, you know what? No, it's okay. It's attacking what you want. What I wanted was to lose weight. And I was... well, it was a self-sabotage thing. And it'll do this with anything.
Yeah.
If you're doing well in your relationship, it will try and self-sabotage. Oh, no, Austin, you don't want this relationship. You know, no. If you're getting on with your family, it'll be like, no, you don't get on with your family. You want to have sex with them or stab them or something. Mm. You know, and just having that reminder that, like, nah, it's doing this because it's the opposite of who I am. I actually find it affirming, you know. I use that with my POCD clients, ROCD clients, violence, you know, harm OCD, kind of thing. If you're doing well in life, harm OCD or suicide OCD will come in and be like, yeah, but are you? You know, what if you're depressed? You know, it's the self-sabotaging nature of it. And even though anxiety is there, like you said, to help you and look after you, when it becomes convoluted and mixes with an internal critic, it becomes an horrible, horrible, nasty voice. Mm-hmm. So my advice always is just, it's thriving because it's the opposite of who you are, and it's trying to sabotage how well you are doing, and you are still doing well. Mm-hmm. If you've done 50, 100 compulsions today, whatever, or whatever, you're still doing well, and you're still halfway there. You've tolerated it. Let's just add the willfulness on.
Yeah. Yeah, really, yeah, absolutely. Good point. Thank you for sharing that. And I think, you know, what was interesting is for that first day or 24 hours, it almost felt like you weren't aware it was OCD or anxiety or...
Utterly convinced.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and you teach this stuff, you're a therapist. I was going to say you therapize this stuff. I don't know if that makes sense. you know, you've written books about it, you've done podcasts. And even so, your brain still managed to convince you, right? So I guess I just wanted to highlight, and I relate to that too. It happened to me like a year ago. For ages, I didn't know it was panic or OCD or whatever. And and that was quite embarrassing not to realize, how have I not spotted this? It's so obvious. So I guess I just want to highlight that from a relapse point of view, that when people are doing well, as you said, and then suddenly... there will come a time where maybe there's a window of time they don't realize they've relapsed, but then they'll catch it as you did. And then you apply the same skills that you did to get better first time.
Yeah, absolutely. Because that's the whole nature of your threat response. As we were talking before, it would be a rubbish response if it didn't feel real.
Yeah.
If you weren't convinced that that was the ultimate threat, then that's not your threat response. And that's why... you know, when you combine that threat response with, and I remember doing this part of OCD Game Changers, and combine it with an element of your personality, which everyone with OCD has, which is the fixator. You are a fixator that is not negative. It's actually beautiful and creative and wonderful. When you fixate, people who are fixators, I made up that word, by the way, it's not actually in the dictionary, when you fixate, a fixator channels all their focus and is able to channel all their focus on something creative or a project or something at work or planning or whatever, you'll find that they thrive. That's why so many people with OCD are incredibly creative. I found that for years in this practice, and people who I know, they're always creative. They're always into the arts and things like that. You know, you can see that all the time. Or not just that, they'll have an outlet where there's lots of levels of creativity. But when you combine that with, you know, a threat response that wants to go banana, and then that's why we struggle with OCD, because I'm a fixator. When I fixate on wonderful things happen. When I fixate on something like threat, God, imagination takes over, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. And so I'm filled with that adrenaline and cortisol, which is going to convince me that this very vivid, creative image in my mind is real. So when I had my latest trigger, like, you know, I'm still on the scales. My rational brain knows, you know, it's just dumb. But my threat response is way more convincing, especially with the adrenaline and cortisol. Yeah, for 24 hours, I was utterly convinced until I asked myself the same question I ask. I don't know who says this. I don't know if it's Reed Wilson or if it's David Carbonell or someone like that. The Russian roulette question.
Is that Grayson? Yeah. John Grayson says it, I think.
Yeah, like if there was a gun to your head right now, and you had to guess whether this was real or fake. And I was like, yeah, actually, I think this is an OCD compulsion. Yeah. I'm 51% sure this is an OCD compulsion. And then I practice what willful tolerance and kindness to myself. So, okay, well, my nervous system's going bananas. I'm going to stop what I'm doing. I'm going to rest. You know, I'm going to allow the stuff there. I'm not going to compulse. I'll allow myself to do a couple of compulsions later because I want to go to bed. Not got it perfect. Didn't suddenly just snap all the compulsions off, but I slowed down. It's been 5-6 days now. It's still lingering, but it's about a 3 out of 10 as opposed to a 9 out of 10.
Yeah.
And I'm happy with that. I'll let it go. It will turn off. It always does, no matter what the theme. You know, it's like, and that's what I say. And it just honestly, it feels like all my other themes, the feeling is the same.
Yeah.
You know, and that it just wants my attention and I'm not going to allow it.
Yeah. Brilliant. Brilliant. Brilliant way to end on that, I think. Mm-hmm. So look, if you could pick up the phone and call the 20-year-old Josh, what'd you tell him?
Oh, God. Oh, do you want that really honest?
Yeah, let's try it.
I'd say you're doing all right. You're going to develop an anxiety disorder and you're going to experience grief soon. So go easy on yourself and spend some more time with your brother, because you're not going to have him for too long. And spend some more time with your dad, because you're not going to have him for too long. And lay off the drugs a bit.
Just a bit.
But also, I'd say, you're doing all right. I'd also tell you, way better looking than what you think you are. Because I looked back the other day, I was like, God, yeah, I was all right looking, but I was crippled by self-doubt and all that stuff. I was like, oh, God. Yeah, I'd also say put 100 quid on Wigan winning the FA Cup, because you'll be a millionaire.
Yeah. Or Leicester to win the Premier League.
Or Leicester to win the Premier League, yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah, thank you for being honest. And then lastly, you've got a billboard in Manchester. What do you want written on that billboard?
You are not your horrible thoughts.
Nice.
I'd love to see that. In fact, I might just do that as graffiti somewhere.
Yeah.
I mean, what? I'm not. Yeah. You are not your horrible thoughts. Yeah. You're not them. They're just the nonsense. Yeah. You know, you are the person who chooses what thoughts kind of matter to you.
Mm.
You know, like this morning I was thinking about some stupid, like, playing computer games or whatever, my car being fixed or whatever, or just in my imagination. But then I had like a thought of a loved one, and I was like, oh, I like that one.
Mm.
That means a lot to me.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, you can't choose what thoughts you get, but you can choose which ones to respond to or which ones you put
forward. Yeah, and which matter to you, no matter what feeling they evoke as well. OCD will tell you that they matter, but they're not, you know, now. Just because my threat response is going off does not mean that's any more important. You know, Hollyoaks comes on the TV after The Simpsons. That triggers my threat response, but it doesn't mean Hollyoaks is important. Mm. That is a great analogy.
Does it actually trigger your threat response? Or?
No, I just really hate it.
Fair enough. Brilliant. So lastly, is there anything else you wish you could have said or shared?
No. Thank you very much for having me on, Stu. It's a wonderful podcast, and I can't wait to listen to it back once I forgot what at all so I spoke about.
Yeah, no, look, thank you so much for coming on. I wanted you on for a while, so it was great to meet you in London and then have this conversation now.
Yeah, no, thank you, Stu, and come on to the Panic Pod as well once I've booked in season. I'm doing season 3, an OCD season. Brilliant. So that'll be great.
Yeah, I'll be there.
Love to have you on.
Cool. All right, thanks, mate.
See you later, buddy.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. And if you want to find out more about NoCD, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.